From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jay Bahadur was just getting his career in journalism off the ground when the stories of piracy in Somalia hit the headlines. The story came to a head when three Somali pirates were killed by U.S. Armed Forces in 2009 after they hijacked the commercial ship the Maersk Alabama. Bahadur wanted to know more about these pirates and the forces that brought them to piracy in the first place. So he went to Somalia, and he's written a book about that experience. The hijacking of the Maersk Alabama is the subject of the new Tom Hanks film, Captain Phillips. So today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation about the pirates of Somalia. It's a place Bahadur sees as the epicenter of a political and a natural disaster. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard not to conjure up certain images when you hear the word pirate. But most of us understand the modern-day pirates that patrol the seas off the coasts of Somalia are very different from the pirates of legend. The journalist Jay Bahadur says there actually are a few things that those pirates and the pirates of today have in common. Their organizational culture, for one, and he says they both share a rich canon of folklore. Jay Bahadur traveled to Somalia to write about pirates, and he joined us a few years ago to talk about what he learned. A new Tom Hanks film called Captain Phillips has recently opened, which tells the story of the hijacking of the U.S. Maersk Alabama. So today in the program, we're going to rebroadcast that conversation. Bahadur wanted to find out how these pirates live their lives, how they came to be pirates in the first place, and what you do to stop a pirate. The book is called The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World. Bahadur was doing contract work for a market research firm, and he was feeling bored, kind of anxious, he says. He told us he was looking for the next step in his professional career, and then he heard about the Somali pirates.
Well, I was looking for a place, a story where I could sort of monopolize it in a way, because that's one of the things, as someone with no experience in actual published writing, no experience in journalism, hadn't been to journalism school, one of the things I could offer was going to places where others weren't. And Somalia was a very good candidate just because I think there's a real stigma about the country stemming from the Black Hawk Down incident.
Yeah.
Of 1993, where 18 U.S. servicemen were killed and mutilated. And there's not the same journalism coverage of Somalia as Iraq or Afghanistan, not the same kind of embedding programs for established journalists. And so when the whole piracy thing exploded, I was really one of the first Westerners there and one of the first, or I should say Western journalists, and really spent more time there than any other journalist. And so, yeah, I was able to kind of get an inside look that maybe others didn't.
Seems like when you went, did you have any sense of who you wanted to write this for? Did you think it was a book? Did you think you would try to pitch it? I mean, did you think that far ahead, I guess?
Yeah, well, I had written about a dozen cold pitches to Canadian nonfiction publishers, or I should say the editors at publishers, nonfiction editors at publishing houses. And I got an immediate two responses from them, and that was unheard of. You know, right. In my time of sending cold pitches to editors, a 1 in 6 response rate was indicative of a very high interest, in my opinion. And so when they found out that I was just a kid recently out of university and never written anything, they kind of trailed off. Mm-hmm. But I stayed in contact with one at HarperCollins, and I did go to Somalia with the intention of writing a book. And it probably sounds very arrogant that I just kind of had this – it was already done in my mind almost. Like I was there, and once I had this liaison with the HarperCollins editor I had already considered it a fait accompli, really, and it did work out that way. It was probably a bit of a overly ambitious expectation at first.
How reckless do you figure it was? I mean, looking back on it now, was it naive? Was it reckless in any way as you look back on it, doing what you did?
I don't think so. It's hard now that, I came back safe and sound, and people's fears and my own fears seem ridiculous now. But going into it, I mean, I hadn't met any of the people who were going to protect me when I was there. I made a contact with a local journalist, and I remember on the plane over there, I started, it was a 45-hour trip, and my mind started playing tricks on me. I started imagining that my partners were themselves pirates, and I would be kidnapped the moment I got there, or at the very least extorted, and basically held in a country where I had no recourse or any sort of way to fight back against people who wanted to extort me for money. The one thing that really convinced me to go was that my partners were Googleable, and he was a journalist. He had a history of things he had written, had a history of a website he had run for about a number of years. And his father had recently been elected the president of Puntland, which was the region I was in. So these people were identifiable. I knew their backstories, and they were, very publicly prominent. So that's why I entrusted my life to them, and it worked out.
Yeah. You described when you first got there, as you mentioned, 50-plus hours to get there. And you talk about when you get there, it's like a country out of a twisted fairy tale. But it's not, you say, and this is an important part of the book. It's not a country in the midst of anarchy, which gets at the question of the myths that you were dealing with, the myths that you yourself, if not believed, at least entertained. Because a lot of this is bursting a lot of myths. Don't you think that's right?
Well, one of the things I was struck by in Somalia is, as you say, it's almost universal that, at the end of a BBC report or a CNN report, someone will tack a line that says Somalia has been in anarchy or has been in chaos or whatnot since 1991, since the Civil War broke out and so on. And this is something that was really not the reality on the ground. And what really struck me was how when the state collapsed, really old forms of social organization, in Somalia this is the clan system,
right.
Really stepped in to take over state networks. So, for example, there's no public bus service, but when my luggage was left behind 300 kilometers away, the next day it was just brought by someone, and it was because everyone has these social networks, and so someone made a call, and someone just brought it on the back of a van or something that was heading up in the right direction the next day. You have a flat tire. I don't know how it happens, but someone shows up immediately, fixes the tire, and leaves. So these are the sort of things. There's no AAA and so on. These are the things that that have really stepped in, and organizations of clan and family have really stepped in to fill the void of the state network, which I found that was one of the most fascinating observations, I think, that I made when I was there.
You described the concept of clan in Somalia as being like a mental grammar of how one processes the world. You talk about how expansive it is and how that it actually seems like everyone does seem to know each other based on this odd connection of clans.
Yeah, and it's really this is really, I think, a mode of social organization that's come out of the fact that most of Somalia is a quite desert, semi-arid environment where herding has been a traditional way of sustenance, a way of life. And sort of similar to, I guess, you see with the Bedouin, where you have very scarce resources and a nomadic lifestyle. You come together in very strong organizations that protect each individual against the outsider and protect the clan's resources and so on. And this mode of organization has really persisted. And in my opinion, that's what tore Somalia apart in the first place, that it was an attempt to make a modern centralized state where everything was still done through clan networks. And obviously the former dictator, Siad Barre, as he became more and more pressed and as things crumbled around him, he relied even more and more on his own clan network and his security apparatus that was, of course, inhabited by all his own clan members. So Somalia blew up, I think, as a result of essentially clan divisions and still remains very fragmented because of these divisions. So Puntland, again, the region I was in, is basically a clan state. It's a state made up of one of Somalia's three major clan families. and called the Darod.
Right.
And this is really the reality of Somalia now on the ground.
There's a frightening story you relate from a former Reuters correspondent that kind of explains the importance of clan lineage, certainly during the days of civil war.
Yes, so this was Aidan Hartley, who a fantastic journalist who had essentially a mental breakdown after covering Somalia, Rwanda, Ethiopia, and of course during the worst times in each country. Now lives he's Kenyan, Kenyan origin. Now lives on a farm in Kenya, but he in Mogadishu again. I think he was there in 1993, and he describes how there were just a queue of civilians lining up, and he suddenly sees one of them shot in the head. And he asked his guard, why, you know, what happened? He said, well, the guy had the wrong ancestors. And what was happening is that each civilian was reciting his clan lineage back generations and generations, back, you know, 1,000 years almost. A lot of the, you know, a lot of people trying to escape the killings would give a false account. So his guard turned to him and said, you know, he should have borrowed the ancestors of a friend. This was very, you know, this is the kind of, I guess I say, you know, it's a mental grammar, and this is, you know, the importance of clan lineage persists. I mean, it's not quite as vicious as that anymore. And generally what's happened is that people of different clans have now coalesced into their own little mini states of Somalia. But, yeah, it's that story illustrates exactly how important a clan is in Somalia.
It seems like you had to get a handle of that, and I think you seems you learned that fairly early on in this process, that you had to figure that out if you were going to get to these pirates.
Yeah, well, I mean, the number one advantage I had was that my partner and his father, the president, were the same subclan as many of the early fishermen pirates. So these were guys who, in Ael, which was until a couple years ago was the pirate capital of Somalia, this tiny fishing town on the eastern coast. My partner's father, President Mohamed Abdirahman Farole, was born in Ael actually, and this was the same place, as I said, that a lot of these early fishermen began fighting out against illegal fishing and then became pirates, the first generation of Somali pirates. And that connection, I was essentially a guest of their clan. I came with my hand stamped, and that was, I guess you can almost say that was the clique I was with, that was the gang I was with, and that's the main reason why the pirates agreed to speak to me.
Let's talk about one of the men you met that you write about, I guess he's one of the original pirates from this time in Somalia, a man named Abdullahi Abshir, known as, is it Boya?
Boya, yeah.
Boya.
Yeah.
Let's start with the meeting, which it's quite an undertaking, first of all, to even get a meeting with him. It took, I think you said, 5 days. And you point out in the book that pirates are hard people to track down.
Yeah, they're always switching phone numbers. I mean, one of the reasons they're always changing numbers is to avoid people calling them for money. the moment they come into any ransom money, their friends and relatives are on the phone to them. And even these pirates, when I spoke to them, I mean, they'd be getting calls every couple minutes, and I understand exactly why they'd want to change phone numbers. But yeah, so Boya, my partner finally arranged a meeting with Boya, and he insisted on meeting him at an abandoned farm about 15 kilometers outside of the capital. And this was ostensibly because he was afraid that Boya had tuberculosis. But I was, of course, nervous that I was just being brought to some field to be killed. I mean, this was the first week I was there or so on. So I just met him in this clearing at this very eclectic farm where they were growing tomato plants and lemon trees, a lot of weird things. Boya was completely disdainful of me. I encountered among Boya one of the first real problems of dealing with pirates is that they won't want to tell you the truth, really. So he's extremely disdainful and quite menacing. I mean, he was about 6'7", 6'8", and he was incredibly thin and emaciated. You know, he could have had tuberculosis. Essentially, he wouldn't even meet my eyes. He sat there just squatting on the ground, playing with a little wooden container and answering his cell phone every couple minutes. Started grumbling halfway through the meeting that the day was over and he just wanted to get away.
Right.
And yeah, it was over the 3 months. Well, I spent about 3 months there total. But over these trips, I slowly gained Boya's trust. Yeah. And at the end, he actually gave me a hug before I left. So I think I'd worked my way into his confidence a little more.
Well, what do you call a Somali pirate? I mean, you talk about that Boya, he himself didn't like the term pirate. They don't like the term.
Yeah, I occasionally got some bristling responses when I used the term pirate, because they recognize the English word pirate, of course. And so some of them would say, you know, no, we're not pirates. Illegal fishing ships are the real pirates. So one term that they use that I speak about in my first meeting with Boya is Badadita Bada, which means saviors of the sea. Yeah. And that's a term that they sometimes use to refer to themselves. And that's in opposition, of course. The normal Somali word for pirate is Borat Budet, which means sea robber. So there's a kind of dichotomy between how regular Somalis see them and how they themselves see themselves. But this has often been, the saviors of the sea has often been translated or represented as coast guards. So they view themselves in some way as coast guards as well.
Well, you write about his moral compass, I think is how you put it. How does he explain what he's doing? I mean, he says he knows what he's doing is wrong, but he also sees part of what he's about is actually protecting the sea. I mean, there is a kind of sense of morality here that he applies, it seems.
Yeah, and one reason I made Boya and by extension his entourage, his extended gang, as the central characters in this book were because they had a great moral ambiguity about them, where you know, in order to make people sympathetic characters in a work, you need to have some reason to feel sympathetic for them. And Boya and his men, you know, had that. Were sympathetic characters in the sense that they were fishermen. Yeah. In the early 90s, they were subjected to all sorts of abuses by thuggish foreign fishermen, and which have been documented by the UN and by the third parties. You know, they'd be shot at, their nets would be destroyed. One case that I heard from the local people were that two lobster divers, and Boya and his men were originally lobster divers, were swept up in a trawler net and drowned. And these aren't things that they were making up out of whole cloth. They were certainly perhaps have been exaggerated by pirates, but they had that justification, and they did begin by attacking foreign fishing ships and stealing their catch, and in some cases ransoming the ship back to its parent company. So they had that history, and when I was interviewing them, when I was meeting them, they were going through this, I called it in the book, a religious redemption movement, where they had forsworn piracy and were actually actively literally sort of dragging kids who were considering becoming pirates, potential pirate recruits, to the mosque and making them swear to never join the pirates. And I compare this in the book to, you know, these ex-cons who go and speak to high schoolers and try to warn them about their lives. But not to ruin the end of the book, but let's just say Boya has has a bit of trouble escaping the gangster life, and he never really gets out of it. But this struggle that he faces between what he claims are his Muslim values, which of course do not look kindly on theft and piracy, and then of course his original rationale. So there was a great, like I said, moral conflict in him that I found very very interesting.
Jay Bahadur is with us. His book is called The Pirates of Somalia: Inside Their Hidden World. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the story of Somalia's pirates. Our guest is Jay Bahadur, whose first real experience, one of his first anyway, real experiences as a journalist came when he traveled to Somalia to write about the world of modern-day pirates. The story that he came back with is intricate as well as interesting. It's about a complicated political and social history, about tribal and a complicated tribal and clan system. It's an intimate look at pirates, how they live, and the forces that brought them there. It's called The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World. Jay Bahadur, describe the structure of Somali pirate society, if you can call it structured. I mean, it is a loose confederation, is how you put it in the book.
Yeah, so one thing that I found very challenging was, especially since I was having all my interviews translated from Somali, was elucidating their hierarchical structures, how they organize themselves. Yeah. And so, for example, Boya in our first meeting referred to himself as, one, the chief of the Coast Guard, and number two, as sitting on a central committee. And so these are words that, you know, might connote something in English, but we don't really know what Boya meant by that, whether it was something that was lost in translation. But over time, as I studied the problem from both inside and I read also other, you know, other sources, it became clear that, yeah, essentially Boya was a part of a network of financiers, and he was not in any sense a mafia leader or someone who held strict control over a defined group of people. It was more like like you mentioned, a constellation of friends and relatives and clan members who would gravitate around these key financiers who would supply capital for the mission. Would outfit a couple skiffs, a couple RPGs, food, fuel, cot, of course, which is this leafy narcotic that pretty much is all pirates are universally addicted to, and they would then take a large percent of the ransom, ranging from 30% to 50%. So, and this is still generally how piracy is operated. What has happened is that, whereas in Boya's days, he was very active in 2007, 2008, and somewhat in 2009, there may have been that the central committee essentially provided funds. So it may have been more than one person. Now what you're increasingly seeing is individual financiers, what I call the single investor model, where just one man will front all the cash, will front all the operating expenses when the ship has been captured and brought into captivity. I mean, he has to supply food and cot and so on for a team of 50 to 150 people for months at a time. So that the bill runs up very quickly. But then he'll take off the top 50% of the ransom. So this is generally how it's structured. It's social networks centering around key financiers, of which it's estimated they're anywhere from 15 to 40 in Somalia. But now what's happening is intelligence organizations and crime-fighting organizations, Interpol and so on, have begun to track pirate groups, not through any sort of centralized structure or defined membership, but just tracking these key financiers and also translators, interpreters, the men who are brought on board to negotiate, because they're sort of the face of Somali pirates, and they're being tracked now as well as they move around to different groups.
It's interesting. I wondered, once you are a pirate, can you choose to stop being a pirate? I mean, Boya said to you, and I couldn't tell if he was joking or not, but he did say that the only way you leave is when you die. Well, so was he serious?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he was being a bit facetious.
Yeah.
I mean, he expressed during our entire interviews, you know, entirely cavalier attitude to death. And that was the response that I am when I asked him if anyone leaves Somalia, because there's all these reports of pirates using the money to finance overseas business networks, you know, move out of the country and so on. And that's simply not the case. And I think Boya was just being facetious by saying they only leave when they die. Because even now, being a pirate doesn't entail a huge risk of dying.
Yeah.
I found that, first of all, the money lasts a very short time.
Right.
So it's literally the pirates come ashore, they blow their money within a couple of weeks, and then either quit or join another mission. But there's a lot of turnover. It's not like I said, there's not any defined membership. Huge rate of turnover in the groups. So they don't there are a lot of people quitting.
It seems like there was a kind of a Robin Hood element to it. I mean, some of the booty, it seems went to, I'm not sure if it still does, but went to the poor and the disabled of local communities. I'm wondering, does it still work like that? Did it ever work like that very well?
Yeah, that's a good question, because Boya in his interviews, this was another case of not really understanding the translations. And in a number of interviews, not just with me, but Boya referred to giving 10% of the money to charity, quote unquote. Hmm. And so what does charity mean? I mean, he's not giving it to, you know, United Way or something. And it turns out that over time, again, I figured that what he meant by charity was 10% would essentially go off to pay off the town elders. So in AL, for example, he'd just give money to, as he'd be expected to, as a token of respect to elders of his own clan. But he'd give these payoffs so they'd, you know, townspeople wouldn't bother him, and he'd have the elders on his side. So that's what was meant by charity. Mm-hmm. When I went to AL, I asked the townspeople. I kind of held an informal town meeting, and I asked them, you know, how come everything was so poor and destitute? I mean, there were one-story houses everywhere, some yeah. cobbled out of driftwood. I asked them, you know, what happened to Boya's charity, and they responded, "Well, the only one he gives charity to is himself." So this was the attitude of the local people, and now it's gone. I mean, there's a huge anti-pirate sentiment on the ground now. It's one of the factors leading to this is, I think, pirate groups now are composed of a lot of foreign, like, outsiders, basically people from outside the local clans that come in and use the towns as a base. So, you know, they abuse the local people, steal women away, you know, are very un-Islamic. They chew khat all the time and drink alcohol. And in a lot of cases, townspeople have come together and formed militias and driven them out. So the response on the ground has been very negative.
So explain how it works. I mean, I was surprised at how random almost, or anyway, simple it was, the process they used to decide what kinds of ships to target.
Yeah, well, there wasn't really much of a process. Boya spoke of just a dichotomy between commercial ships and I think he called them tourist ships, meaning yachts and, you know, these poor yachters who've been captured in recent times. And even back in Boya's day, there were some yachts captured. But he referred to these as tourist ships, and then commercial ships, which were identifiable by the cranes and their deck. So, yeah, that was about as complex as his hunting system was. Pirates typically attack in teams of two skiffs, one to cover the other one as it approaches and boards the vessel using aluminum or a rope ladder. And really, in a lot of cases, these pirates are out there with not enough food and fuel to get back. And it's just a matter of going out to the shipping lanes, waiting for something to come along, cutting your engines, cause, you know, you need to conserve fuel, and just wait for a target to come along. And, you know, really any target that comes is an oasis, really. And the one of the myths I try and tackle in the book is that the idea that pirates are using sophisticated intelligence networks, you know, people spotting ships for them, reading crew ship manifests and transmitting the information. In the end, it's extremely difficult to intercept a ship on the high seas, especially when you're not versed in marine navigation and you have like a very simple commercial GPS system, and that sort of thinking negates the real opportunism behind piracy, which is just go out, capture a ship, and any crew, it's the crew that's valuable. Yeah. It's not, in the end, it's not really the ship itself. It's the crew that's valuable, and really capturing any crew is going to guarantee you money. So it's not nearly as sophisticated as people think. I don't know. It's my belief.
Mm. Talk about cut. You write an entire chapter about this, and I have to say, yeah. It's really extraordinary, the level to which it provides a kind of motivation for all of this. I mean, it's incredibly complicated. The history of the social and political history of Somalia comes into play here too. But khat also plays a role, it seems. It's a social drug. First, explain what it is and kind of how it works.
Well, khat is just a leaf. It's a shrub that's grown in Ethiopia and Kenya and Yemen, not Somalia itself. And it's a mild stimulant. that if maybe chewed for a whole day can become a little more than mild. Mm. But it's similar sort of to coca leaf in South America. And this has never traditionally been a drug problem in Somalia and has been used over the years. In the past, has been used often by Islamic scholars to, let's say, enhance their studies, allow them to study late into the night and so on. But it's now become a real epidemic in the Horn of Africa in general, Yemen in particular. But now Somalia is becoming more and more awash in khat. And one of the main reasons for this is piracy. Yeah. And the fact that I'll venture that the single number one expense of pirates or what they spend their money on is khat. It costs about $20 a kilo, and the kilo might last an addict a whole day. But when you're a pirate, you have your friends and family who are expecting you to pay and to pay for them, and sort of like, you know, I guess like rappers with their large entourage or whatnot. The Somali pirates are expected to buy khat for a large entourage, and at $20 a person each day, you know, the money evaporates pretty quickly.
Well, you write about your own experience chewing khat, which didn't seem to do much for you. I guess in some ways you thought, it didn't really work for me, but you used it, and I loved this. You talked about mostly as a way to fit in.
Yeah, it was a great. I talk about it as a great interviewing tool because one of the things it does is it loosens you up and in many cases makes you talkative and you know, maybe more liable to spill the beans on the latest ship you've hijacked. But yeah, so I would buy it for them. We go out for khat picnics and with Boy and his men, I'd bring the khat along. And that was, you know, the way to their heart that I was in after that. It was khat itself when I chewed it. I mean, it's chewing like chewing any random plant. If you imagine what that tastes like, it's just tastes like bitter filth. And in fact, it's so unappealing that this super sweet tea is always brought along with it just to cover up the taste. But for me, it didn't do much. I found it like a strong cup of coffee, really. But yeah, that, you know, that wasn't really the main purpose of my use of it.
Yeah. It was the way to the pirate's heart, I think.
Yeah.
Getting to how they came to be pirates, one of the questions you ask Boya is, you know, where do you guys receive your training? And it seems like his response is telling. It seems like it comes from circumstance, from desperation, from famine, I guess, is how he puts it. But obviously it's more complicated than that. What brings a person fundamentally to be a pirate in Somalia?
Well, right now I think it's very much just the lure of money. I think it's more pull than push, as I like to say. I think these groups that originally were fighting for their livelihoods as fishermen, as Boya and his men early on, really that sort of motivation doesn't exist anymore. Now the kind of pirate you see tends to be just an inland militiaman, someone with a gun and who knows a financier. And although, I mean, life in Somalia is very difficult, obviously, and there's a lot of hunger and whatnot, the recent famine and the worst of it is located in the south of the country, and Puntland has been largely isolated. And historically, I mean, there's occasional droughts in Puntland and so on, but historically the people there are much better off than those in the south. And it's interesting that although piracy began as a reaction against illegal fishing, and a lot of the early leaders gained their experience through attacking fishing ships, the man who invented this current business model, i.e. hijacking the crew, holding the crew ransom, was actually a former civil servant and who was basically returned to his homeland south of Puntland, a little region called Galmudug, and started financing it like a business, just realized immediately that, you could hold people for ransom on the sea. Mm. And he had no history in fishing. Like I said, he was a formal civil servant. But his model and his very businesslike attitude to it, his name was Afuene, which means big mouth, spread up and down the coast. And a lot of these early Puntland leaders then came down and started training more and more crews, you know, using their relative knowledge of marine navigation and so on. So it was. It's interesting that the business model that's really taken off and has led to this modern scourge did not originate from fishermen. So the history of piracy is really a lot more complex than a lot of media outlets try to portray, which is that, you know, imperialistic foreign fishing came in, poor local people reacted, and this is a result. It's a lot more nuanced than that. Mm.
In the early days, there wasn't much, fewer risks you talk about, smaller payouts though, but now I think you mentioned one of the highest ransoms so far, maybe the highest, $10 million not so long ago.
Yeah, there was a report, an unconfirmed report, that actually $18 million was paid by the Italian government to release, I think it was a tugboat containing their own citizens. Not sure if it was if that was the type of boat, but it was definitely holding Italian citizens, but that's unconfirmed. But yeah, actually, I think now the highest confirmed amount is $13.5 million. So, yeah, and there was a very good op-ed by Robert Young Pelton, who runs a website called Somalia Report. And he argues that the pirates are essentially pricing themselves out of a good business model because now ransoms have gotten so high that violence has become a much more acceptable option on the part of the international naval forces and on the part of the ship owners. So what you're seeing now is a lot more ship owners are using armed security on board, and there's been a number of incidents where pirates have been repelled by armed security. And so far, there's not one case of pirates successfully hijacking a vessel equipped with armed security. So essentially, their own greed and the perpetually escalating ransoms have proved self-defeating. And what Pelton argues is that this is the beginning of the end for Somali piracy. I'm not that optimistic about it, but I do think that that ransoms have really have, or these escalating ransoms have really adversely affected the pirates' business model.
I wanted to ask you about the. There's a story that Boya tells you, because you had asked him what was his most exciting sea chase, and he tells you the story of the Golden Nori. Which you can talk about if you like. But to me, it seems what's interesting about that story was just how complicated all of this can be, you know, for Americans and others, that this jurisdiction question is really difficult. I mean, the Americans at least didn't know quite what to do with Boya and his men when they did capture them.
Right. So the Golden Nori was a Japanese-owned chemical tanker. Was actually one of the first big commercial hijackings in the Gulf of Aden. And it was carried out personally by Boya. And he describes how after capturing the ship, they steered it towards Bosaso, which is Puntland's most populous city. It's a northern port. And he was being tailed by four U.S. warships and decided to take it to Bosaso because he said that he wanted the civilians as a basically to use them as a screen. He thought the Americans wouldn't attack him if the civilian population was nearby. And considering that this was a chemical tanker, the risks of a major catastrophic incident were higher than, say, on other ships. But then it was actually only recently. I mean, what happened was Boyd, he joked about, you know, as the negotiations dragged on, that he would need to eat the crew and so on. And in the end, payment of $1.5 million was agreed, and his men were simply allowed to let go. And I asked him once they had departed the ship and there were American attack helicopters nearby, why the Americans let them go. And he said, because that was our arrangement. But it was only actually very recently, through the whole WikiLeaks thing, that there was a cable released that exposed the Americans' real motivations. Were that, and those were that they were concerned this was a terrorist hijacking. That essentially they thought that Boya and his men, they had hijacked a chemical tanker. They were worried that they were going to ram it into Aden or attempt to attack U.S. fleet in the area, similar to the USS Cole attack and so on. So this was, it was funny because Boya was under this impression that, you know, that they had struck a deal with the American military, and that they were men of honor and so on. But really, they just didn't care about they didn't care about Boy and his men getting $1.5 million. They had other concerns. And it was only when piracy really got out of control that that the American military started focusing on piracy, and they actually there was a task force, combined task force 151, which was then created specifically to deal with piracy. But at the very beginning, I mean, it was just a golden age for the pirates because, you know, it wasn't for any country. It wasn't a high strategic objective, preventing you know, these attacks, and until it, you know, got really out of control.
That's Jay Bahadur. He's the author of the book, The Pirates of Somalia. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Jay Bahadur. He's the author of the book, The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World. The film Captain Phillips has recently opened. It stars Tom Hanks. It tells the story of the hijacking of the U.S. Maersk, Alabama. We're taking the opportunity to rebroadcast our conversation about modern-day pirates, how they live their lives, and the forces that brought them to piracy in the first place. Jay Bahadur, I wanted to ask you about a young pirate named Umbali, I think is how you pronounce it. Mm-hmm. That was his nickname anyway. Because it's interesting about what it seemed to tell you about Somali society and about the rank-and-file pirate. I mean, he's a rank-and-file pirate, I guess we can say.
Yeah, he was a good example of exactly one of the trends that had led to piracy. Umbali was, at the time that I interviewed him, was serving in the Puntland Militia, their military forces, but he had been a former pirate, and one of the real impetuses that led to the explosion of piracy in 2008 was that the Puntland government ran out of money to pay its security forces. So you had about 5,000 young men with guns who suddenly had no employment. And a lot of these guys were recruited either as attackers, as members of the attacking teams, or more likely just as guards to hold to guard the hostages once the ship was captured. And so Umbali claimed to have participated in two missions as a guard. And then once President Farole, my partner's father, was elected in January 2009, he suddenly got a job in the militia because he was the same, belonged to the same clan as Farole. So, suddenly his employment prospects had opened up again. And Farole began paying the armed forces again. And but then I asked him, what happens if your aspirations with this government don't pan out? And he just said, well, then I'd go back to the pirates. And this is sort of the case that you have not only members of the Puntland militia, but actually there were a number of Coast Guard projects where private security firms came in the late 90s and early 2000s, trained local militia members in marine navigation and boarding and seizures and marksmanship skills that obviously were very applicable to activities on the opposite spectrum to law enforcement. Yeah. So it's one of these cases where you have seamless transitions between Coast Guards, between pirates, between the local militia forces. And
being fishermen too, I guess.
Yeah, fishermen as well. Yeah, of course. And one of the funniest things I found is that some of the pirates that I was interviewing, namely Boya and another man named Garad Muhammad, who's actually one of the financiers behind the famous Maersk, Alabama incident, were trying to form Coast Guards, like official government Coast Guards. They were trying to get funding from the government to form a Coast Guard. And Garad, personally, his cousin was running the current official government Coast Guard in Puntland. And he had basically taken his pirate militia and had joined the Coast Guard. At one point, I had a government official basically just haranguing this Coast Guard and saying their ranks are filled with pirates. These are crazy people. Mm-hmm. And he was describing an incident where they had allegedly boarded an illegal fishing vessel. But their strike team was made up of pirates. So you have this sort of incestuous world of constantly shifting career choices. And so it's very difficult to, you know, there's been a lot of allegations that the Puntland government itself is complicit or involved in piracy. And when you have, it's very hard to refute those allegations when you have, you know, people who've been in the armed forces, people, you know, people who've been Coast Guards involved in piracy and coming in and out of the coming in and out of the trade. So yeah, it was a very, very difficult story to keep track of.
Well, it seems like for Umbali, for example, I mean, he made decent money. I mean, I think you tell of two particular jobs, he made $50,000 over the course of these two jobs over a series of months. I mean, that's pretty good money. So, but can you on a regular basis as a rank and file pirate, you know, not a high ranking one, can you make much money? Is that still the incentive? I mean, clearly it is in some ways, but does it continue to be?
Well, Umbali actually, that was he was also very illustrative of the pirate tendency to lie or to not understand money, because he claimed to have made $50,000 and then also claimed that there were 50 guards, something around 50 guards, and 30% of the money was split among those guards. And when I actually worked out the numbers, it worked out to not more than $19,000-$20,000. So I think either he was exaggerating, or what's more likely is that he simply had no concept of how much money he had gotten and it had just gone through his fingers, and now he was just penniless again. Claims to have invested in pirate missions. I don't know if that's true or not. But yeah, it's just very, very hard to track exactly how much each pirate makes and where they spend the money and so on, just because I think they have little idea themselves. It was fascinating. There were early stories of when multi-million dollar ransoms started arriving, that pirates would be running into the cot market as soon as they got their payoff and were didn't understand that U.S. $100 bills were different than the 1,000 shilling notes that they normally use, the Somali currency, which is worth, each bill is worth about 3 cents. So, I mean, I'm sure these are exaggerations, but they at least reflect this faithfully the spirit of your average pirate's understanding of money. And Umbali, you know, I would estimate that he probably made around $20,000, and $10,000 was a typical, especially at that time, was about a typical salary for a hostage guard. But like I said, it goes very quickly. Yeah. The money comes and goes very quickly. So there's no sustained rise in the standard of living.
You asked Umbali this, what I thought was this really interesting question. You said with all of your idle time, you know, when you've got a group of hostages, because it's always a sort of a lot of downtime. And you ask him how he got along with the hostages. Talk about his response, because he tells you ultimately that. I mean, you also ask him what would have happened to the hostages that you're with if the ransoms hadn't been paid. And what did you learn from that series of questions?
Well, one thing he said, they treat them very well, and they gave them their, I think he said they gave them their SIM cards back, or maybe gave them their phones back. I don't remember the exact details. Yeah. But I think certainly at that time it reflected that the pirates generally did treat hostages well. I mean, there have been examples of captured documents where they actually had a pirate code of conduct, and sort of number one on this code of conduct was don't abuse the women. You know, if there are women on board, which is rare, number one thing, don't sexually abuse them. And this was actually a written code of conduct. And later, when I interviewed former hostages of a Romanian crew that was captured, there was one woman on board, and they said they treated her with the greatest respect, and you know, would never harass her, and actually accorded her the most preferential treatment out of all of them. But then Umbali, of course, also said that he would have, if ordered to, he would have killed all the hostages, and he said this in quite a you know, matter of fact and chilling way, but I just believe that that never would, you know, that sort of thing never would have been carried out. I think pirate threats to kill the hostages were largely just threats to, you know, to put pressure on the shipping companies, and especially Boya and his men. I just didn't see them as killers, and you know, Boya would constantly say, no, this was only a threat, we never would have done it, and You know, I think he was genuine about that. That being said, in recent days, like I said, the type of pirate who's now out there is fundamentally different than these early days of these fishermen pirates. And and you've seen some murders of hostages, obviously.
Let me ask you this finally. We've got about a minute left. How do you look back on that experience? I mean, you describe it. You know, you had this kind of collection of adrenaline and wonder. But in the epilogue, you say that it's hard not to feel some measure of admiration in some ways for them. I mean, how are you looking back on not only the experience, but the pirates that you met?
Yeah, I've been kicked around a bit for that line.
Really?
when I was talking to my editor, the one thing she said was, you got to get that line out of there. Mm-hmm. And I dumbed it down a little, but it's very easy when the book's getting reviewed for people to kind of gravitate on those sort of lines. But yeah, I mean, when I said admiration, I think I was trying to reflect the spirit that people felt when reading about pirates in that, you know, there's a sense of romanticism and adventure about what they're doing. And the fact that they're outgunned and outmatched, but are still out there, you know, competing with state-of-the-art navies, you know, and back in the day, they did the same thing. They were also outmatched and outgunned.
Yeah, but, you know, I have to say, I interpreted that idea of admiration as more understanding. I mean, and that's essentially what you were after in the first place.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, it's hard to actually come out and say, you know, I understand what the pirates are doing because... Yeah. Right now, like I said, it's an entirely different breed out there, and they've shown themselves to be quite bloodthirsty and barbaric. And I try to draw a dichotomy between those guys out there and the guys in my book who I very much try to humanize. So in short, I don't know if I can come out and say I flat out admire the pirates or agree with the justifications of what they're doing, but for certain groups anyway. You know, you had to feel for them. Those kind of men are largely extinct at this point.
Jay Bahadur, his book is called The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World, joined us from the Canadian Broadcasting Company studios in Toronto. Jay Bahadur, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.